You're listening to St. PDEX Season 2. Today's episode is brought to you by CapEx Advisory Group. When organizations undertake large capital or real estate projects, they turn to CapEx for additional resources and expertise. To learn what an owner's rep can do for you, visit CapEx's website at ceag2.com. That's C-E-A-G, the number 2.com. And by the Open Partnership Education Network, located at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. The world is open for citizens, businesses, groups, for all of us to become a smarter, better connected city by learning together. To find out more about Open, including upcoming great Aresti speakers, please visit learnopen.org. Now enjoy the conversation. Joining me on SPX is journalist Lucy Morgan, won the Pulitzer Prize, was a finalist another time, long time correspondent with the Tampa Bay Times, formerly St. Petersburg Times, and then has continued her work until today. Welcome.
Yes, thanks. I'm so old, I've been through many changes in journalism. Back when I first started with the Times, I started with Ocala, actually, and then the Times. And back then, I had to dictate every story on the phone and send in every picture on a Greyhound bus. And sometimes the buses didn't get there. I have pictures that are traveling yet in the Greyhound system somewhere. They just never got there. But now we can get pictures there in seconds and stories quickly as well, with computers everywhere and satellite internet. And I mean, I spend my summers in the mountains of North Carolina, and we use a satellite internet service that is almost as good as the hardwired one I have in Tallahassee through a phone service.
Well, that long history gives you a front row seat at, you know, the evolution that news has gone through. Can you remember when you sort of saw, or even if it was somewhat retrospectively, when you saw a shift in the way in journalism's trajectory with regard to, you know, revenue or style or just the general business of journalism?
Back when there was traditional advertising and traditional delivery, I don't think anybody envisioned what the ultimate way of getting news to a consumer was going to be. There were people in the 80s who used to predict that there would be no papers delivered on anybody's lawn by the year 2000, that then we would be all electronic somehow. And obviously that didn't happen. We're still putting papers on people's lawns some days. And I know that in St. Petersburg, for instance, and in many other areas, particularly where you have a lot of senior citizens, people really like to pick up a paper in the morning and read the paper. I confess that when we're in the mountains of North Carolina, we drive 10 miles down the mountain on Sundays to pick up a copy of the Sunday New York Times because we like holding pieces of paper to read it. But on some Sundays, if the weather's too bad or something, we use the internet. But this is a very fragmented scene. Some people get all their news on Facebook or Twitter or get what news they get. I think there are a lot of people out there that get no real news beyond what they sort of glean off the television nightly news, and that we have created a very uninformed citizenry out there through all this fragmentation of the news, that people don't know as much as they need to know to vote in a democracy in many instances. And some of them are so busy making a living, trying to raise children and do all the things we have to do. They don't know what they don't know. And I can't see any means we have right now that's going to improve that. But something may come along. When faxes were invented, I don't think people even use faxes anymore. I think our printers have them. But back then, a lot of the news people thought the fax was going to be the ultimate way to deliver news to people's homes or offices. And I don't think anybody does that anymore. We use faxes nowadays more for legal documents to be transferred from one place to another and things like that. So it may be that the medium by which we're going to communicate news simply isn't out there yet.
Do you think that, you know, with the information age, that the sheer quantity of information and also sort of the expertise that is born out of that quantity of information, you know, specifically, I'll say, you know, I might like a certain random kind of bird watching, and I can go on YouTube and find people who, you know, with hundreds of hours of content about just that specific bird and all the techniques for finding that specific bird. And you sort of correlate that over to, you know, waste management in a city, or, you know, that the level of sophistication that has followed, you know, the spread of information such that the experts on any given topic, even, you know, very minute civil topics, it's just impossible for the average citizen to absorb all that in a meaningful way. And so you run into this challenge of trying to put it into bite-sized chunks and get it into people's heads. Mm-hmm. But then you sort of can't help but look at the marketing aspects of that when you're forced to do that.
Yeah. And I think there is a huge disconnect now between what you can get, between getting news to consumers and developing a system of making money off of that. You can send a lot of stuff out, but if you're not making advertising money in some way, you're not going to exist very long. As you mentioned, there's just so much of it out there. And if you really want to know more about a subject, my response is to Google it quickly. And I don't know how I could function without Google, but to pick up additional information on virtually anything. But I do think that if you're only getting what you seek from Google or Facebook or any of the apps that are out there, you're not developing a very well-informed person because you're only looking at what you already know.
Sure. And I think part of that, you know, coming from, I used to run a marketing agency, I knew important, one of our services was search engine optimization. And, you know, one of the, you know, it depends on your perspective, whether it's a curse or a blessing, but a small company on the internet can look the same as a big company on the internet when you're just looking at their websites for the most part.
Yes, absolutely.
And so that brings in this element of being able to, you know, if you do Google it, the savviest marketers are the ones that are going to get the information in your head first.
It's interesting to watch this year's political advertising that's going up. I am seeing more this year than ever on Facebook, for instance. Not so much on Twitter, but much more on Facebook. And some of it is downright clever. Some of it's wrong, too. But Facebook has only really begun to police what's being put up on their pages. And I'm guessing that both Facebook and Twitter and all of these other TikTok things that are out there are going to have to develop a better system of policing what they put up. Mm-hmm. Or we're going to continue to have a lot of badly informed people out there trying to go cast a vote. And the sad thing is that very few people will spend much time researching something themselves in a thorough fashion. They just sort of take what's thrown at them and assume that to be true. And that's simply dangerous for a democracy.
Do you think to some extent that's always been a little bit true in that there are always the people who avidly read the paper and there were always the sort of people who didn't, and those people mainly relied on friends or colleagues or people they sort of figured were like them to get their information? Or
I think that television and to some extent radio, although less, have made that change somewhat. That there were people younger than me probably, but a lot of people who read a paper. Virtually every household got one so that it was there to read if you wanted to. And then as television came along, a lot of people started watching for news on television and getting what it was. And I'm not sure how much that's happening anymore. In our household, we're news junkies and we listen to virtually every newscast all day. But I don't really expect others to do it. And I mean, a lot of our friends and neighbors don't do it. They barely know the major news of the day. And I don't know how we get this communication expanded to the people that need to get it, but it's going to have to be some monumental change and less fragmented than we have now, although we seem to be moving only in a direction of more fragmentation. And if I had the answer to this question, I could be extremely wealthy, I think, but I don't know what we're going to do. I do think that for the sake of elections and public officials and getting information out about what they're doing, we've got to find a better way to do it than we're doing it now.
From my personal viewpoint is that has to be cultivated at the consumer level where you have to make
absolutely
being informed cool. And, you know, to your point, you're a news junkie, other people are not, but their votes count the same as yours. And unfortunately, unless you have a self-drive to go out and get that information to make the most of your vote, you're going to, you know, be susceptible to influence. And the only people who have real incentives and money to put behind driving your opinion are, you know, are certain actors with a stake in a certain outcome. And one of the most effective things that they've done to achieve their goals is to attach identity, you know, your political, who you vote for to some extent, you know, which is, you know, evident in the polarization that we have right now, and that because I feel that I'm right or I'm left, that it's more important for me to go left on something is actually an affront to my actual identity versus just a specific opinion I have about a specific issue. I think there's people that wanted it that way.
I'm not sure that the average citizen thinks that much about right or left. The political devotees who are down in the trenches fighting it out are very hung up on left and right. But around the neighborhoods where I live and talk to people, I virtually never hear someone bring up those terms. Things are triggered by more taxes, blatant corruption. It's got to be pretty blatant, I think, before it triggers a lot of people's anger. And the failure to be efficient in delivering services to people. But I don't hear people saying, well, they're all left wings and they can't do this. I think that is ingrained in a lot of politicians.
Right. I think specifically of examples like immigration, where, you know, one side, you know, Trump was big on the wall, and, you know, he made that something that people got really attached to. And immigration is an issue, but it's just one of dozens of issues, including poverty. And, yeah, you know, and so, you know, just the fact that they made that an issue, that's where I feel like it trickles down into the masses.
Yeah. Well, I think that the mass of people care more about whether their roads are paved and they have efficient utilities and good access to education and an education that seems to be good, that they care more about that than a subject like immigration. If you've got a government that is running smoothly and delivering services and responding to problems, you go a long way in this world, because I'm not sure how informed a lot of people really want to be about the ins and outs of government and politics. This year, more than ever, I have had people say to me, I don't want to know what's going on in the political world.
Right.
They view it all as just bad.
Yeah. So then it's safe to say perhaps then that, you know, the build the wall chants and all that sort of thing are more, you know, they get more airtime perhaps or more attention on social media, but really don't necessarily reflect what the average citizen is thinking about.
I think that's true. And I think that Trump has stirred up some interest in that, obviously. And there are people, particularly middle class and people who have less in this country, who see immigration as a huge threat to them. But if you talk to a businessman or a manufacturer of something or a farmer or anybody, they see immigration as providing a service that they don't get without it, because many Americans are not willing to work for the kind of money that some of the immigrants work for, or to do some of the chores they do. But if you talk to builders in some areas right now, they will tell you that they are very stressed to find workers to do the bottom level jobs when they build buildings and things, because of the restrictions that have been imposed on immigration over the last few years. And so, I mean, it's finding a happy medium in there, I think, that generates support for whatever the government is doing. And I wish I knew what was going to happen with the election, because I might could tell you how much that matters to anybody. But it is very confusing to the average voter, I think, when there's just so much trash out there.
So then, but just following along the lines then with the immigration issue, in a sense, do you feel like the folks who are at the, you know, lower income levels that feel threatened by immigration, they are actually threatened by immigration, or they've had this perception of this threat put into them for political purposes?
I think it's more of a perception than anything else. If you talk to the people who are hiring immigrants to do work, they will tell you that they need them because they can't get others to do it. they don't want to pay enough to get it. And some of the labor is extremely intensive labor that nobody wants to do unless they have to.
We were originally dug into a little bit about the trajectory of the business, and I don't want to escape that because I think there's some interesting events that happened there. Do you remember how you experienced Craigslist when it first started?
I'm not sure I've ever paid attention to Craigslist. I know what it is, and I have been on it rarely. It's not something that ever figured in my own scheme of things.
Well, the big sort of take on that is that Craigslist is, you know, a free classified platform. It became the go-to place for job postings, and it was the first sort of big bite out of newspaper revenue. Yeah, because I think they stole, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was in the, you know, the billions of dollars in aggregate classifieds postings for jobs, and it became the go-to place. Now, obviously, more places came along after that.
Yeah, I was going to say, there are a lot of those now out there that are siphoning. And of course, the one little thing that the legislatures have taken away in recent years has been legal advertising that used to always be in newspapers.
Right.
And that's sort of a political kick in the pants that a lot of legislators like to give their most unfavorite news organization.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. You know, obviously, the fake news thing has bloomed. You know, it's always kind of been around, but it's really bloomed in the last few years, you know, to the point of Truth to Power. You won your Pulitzer for digging into some stuff at the sheriff's office. Do you feel that the, we'll call it just the generic establishment, has gotten an upper hand on really kneecapping media?
It depends on the publication. Some publications, particularly the big city publications, are not as dependent on the legal advertising that government provides as others are. And I think from market to market, that may vary a lot. But I do think that certain politicians see it as a way to punish a story they didn't like that was either broadcast or printed. That's a mechanism they have to get even.
Right.
And they have in recent years used that quite a lot. It hasn't always worked. I think it's working more now because newspapers as an entity seem weaker than they did years ago. There's so many different sources of news out there that people aren't as dependent on the morning paper or the afternoon paper as they used to be.
Right. So they've attacked the revenue side through legislation and other tactics, but what about attacking the credibility side with, you know, the promoting fake news and things like that?
Well, you know, there's always been a tax on, particularly on the editorial positions of news organizations. And people who think, well, there's some underhanded reason that the newspaper supports one thing and not another. So I'm not sure that that's increased any, at least not in the arena I've been swimming in. But there's always been a distrust, I guess you could say, between editorial writers and politicians, particularly. But I really do think that this fragmentation, where so much information comes to people on Facebook or Twitter or all the other electronic means of transmitting it, that it's hard to pinpoint one particular segment of it and do something to them. I hope I live long enough to see where all of this sort of winds up, how news gets delivered, and whether people believe it. I think Trump has done a real disservice to all of the news media. You could take his labeling things fake news. My interpretation of that would be it's news he didn't like.
Sure.
But most of it is indeed true. And if it weren't, he'd be suing everybody's hat off. But the phrase fake news, in my mind, has become more news that a politician didn't like than news that is just made up. There may be news organizations, I'm sure there are a few, some of them, particularly the smaller ones, who make something up about a public official or a politician. But you're not seeing that in the major publications. It's too risky.
But maybe perhaps the real damage, though, is in, you know, again, if you have consumers of information who kind of generally understand objectivity, but their leaders are constantly telling them that it doesn't exist and that there's fake news and they're being fooled, then really what it does is, you know, again, not for the news hounds and the people that are really watching, but for the, you know, a lot of the middle masses, perhaps just degrades their trust in it, which in turn, you know, it's sort of the same logic as, oh, my vote doesn't count, so why bother? It's probably going to be fake news, so why bother reading it? Kind of, you know, I think that's the greater damage, perhaps.
It does not help the reputation of any news organization to have that label applied to them. But, I mean, I don't remember anybody using that term years ago, but there were people who were mad at what we wrote.
Yeah.
But they were more inclined to buy a bumper sticker or something like that and rail at the news organizations. The sheriff I wrote about years ago bought a bumper sticker with my name on it. And I had an elderly woman call my house and tell me he was handing out bumper stickers with my name. And I said, what else is on the bumper sticker?
Huh.
I couldn't figure out why he'd want to promote me. And she said, well, out to the left of your name, there's a nail. I said, could that be a screw? She said, that's it. So he was slandering me with bumper stickers that he handed out with his campaign literature. And I don't guess they have to do that anymore. They just call it fake news or something. But it's another example of how much things have changed over the years.
One of your contemporaries, Gilbert King, recounted a similar story with Sheriff McCall, the reporter in the town that had kind of turned against him. He was making sure none of his cronies and leaning on people who to not advertise with her and to really just hurt her business at her paper.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that, you know, in the concept of objective journalism has evolved or moved, or, you know, sort of parallel lanes of objectivity have opened up, or is it pretty much it has to stick to the same principles as it has, you know, in the 50s and 60s and on?
I think that those of us who work for major news organizations see what we do as objective, that sometimes it gets painted by one side or the other, whose ox was gored or wasn't gored when it comes out, and thus becomes somewhat tainted. But I don't think it becomes any less true. I mean, there are mistakes that everybody makes in every field. There are very few news organizations that set out to write something that is simply not true. The libel laws are good enough to make that a bit too risky. But it's easier nowadays, I think, because everybody's got a platform. Everybody's got a Facebook page or Twitter account, and you can trash whoever you want to. And there's not much penalty for it, even if it's not true. But it becomes very easy to take a phrase like fake news and apply it to a perfectly true story because you want to try to discredit it, and you can't factually discredit it, so you insult it.
And to some extent, the folks on the other side of that are actually getting away with putting out the information that you would get sued if you came at them. You know, they don't have those same requirements for credibility or consequences for not being credible. So it's sort of an unfair situation where one side can throw out whatever they want and the other side cannot.
It's interesting because there are probably not many houses, certainly not middle income or better these days, who don't have several computers running around the house and lots of television and just access to this broad spectrum of information. And I don't remember a time in my life before the last few years when it was just so easy to find a piece of information, no matter how obscure it was. I had a guy call me last week wanting to know if I had any information about Justice James Atkins, a former Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court, who I covered many years ago when he was a circuit judge in Levy County, Florida. And then again, covered him when I was Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Times, and he was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So I gave him the name of one of the people at the Supreme Court that keeps track of history of all things. And within a minute, he emailed me a copy of a story that I had written in 2005 about that Chief Justice when he died. He Googled it up. So there's just so much information that's easily accessible out there. It's amazing to me. And most of it, I shouldn't say most of it, a lot of it is quite accurate and has been published somewhere. And it's just lurking out there to be found. But years ago, you had to really work to find that kind of information on somebody or something.
Yeah, and that sort of brings me to social journalism. You know, when you look at a big part of the craft historically of journalism was getting that information. You know, I make the parallel because we see social media and what it's done, you know, specifically more like in the YouTube realm or whatever, is that it's brought this knowledge and these processes and to some extent the tools. And the average person, you know, in their basement now can make a production that probably rivals Star Wars or something from 15 years ago. And so what we've essentially done is given the means for the individual and elevated media. And you actually got your start not intending to be a journalist. The lady who ran the local paper just showed up at your house and said, you know, hey, we need a writer. And I heard you read a lot. Come be our writer. You know, so is there a way forward where we give the tools and the processes and the information, as you pointed out, is available via the internet, and we can elevate journalism amongst individuals in the same way we've elevated media?
Well, I think there probably is. Getting circulation among people that might read it would be more difficult.
Right.
I mean, Joe Smith out there in the hustings can look up stuff and write it, but how he gets it circulated at the moment is dependent on places like Twitter and Facebook and all the other social media. And there's no money in that.
Right. But what about a world where, you know, a news platform, and again, I'm speaking directly of the Catalyst because this is what we're aspiring to be, you know, our vision is potentially that we could have our pro journalists and then give the tools and also the same rules to citizen journalists, and, you know, the same way they, an insane amount of content is put up on every social media platform every day, this might be a good outlet for the right kind of journalism or content.
I mean, if somebody has time to play with it, to play with social media and put stuff up on it and do it and not get paid well for doing it, I wonder how much of it will exist.
Mm-hmm. And the way that works now is there are monetization, you know, people can make just millions of dollars if their content, you know, garners that attention on social media platforms. How social media platforms have worked is to, you know, monetize that content for the individual through rev share. So, you know, what that looks like is you put your content up. If it attracts an advertiser, we share in that revenue. So I think the same sort of logic would hold true for a platform that was going to really be able to scale.
Well, it'd be interesting. It might be hard to manage, but I mean, a whole lot of time at news organizations goes in to editors who essentially manage the product, who make sure the words are spelled right and the facts are right and that it's done on a deadline and those kind of things, which aren't very glamorous, but necessary.
Right. So you'd need that layer of utility and quality control, really, to make it work.
Yeah, I think you would. You know, we probably have a better educated group of people out there trying to do these things than we might have had many years ago. You still can't trust people to do things correctly without somebody reading over their shoulder.
Do you remember when, you know, when you got that knock on the door and you said yes? Do you remember the first, you know, few stories that you wrote and what instruction you got? And
go to the city council or to the Kiwanis Club or anywhere and write what happens, was the instruction I got. Huh. Go to the scene of every fatal accident or murder and write us what occurred there. And I, to this day, have never had an editor tell me they wanted me to write a story and slant it to make a certain person look better or worse than whatever you saw in front of you.
Right.
It was the simple suggestion that you should write what you see.
Sure. You know, traditional news organizations didn't, you know, unless the editor, for whatever personal reason, had a massive slant, you know, their businesses suffered if they did that. You know, and the difference now is businesses don't suffer if they do that. They actually thrive if they do that.
I think I'd have a lot of trouble trying to write, for instance, political ads for politicians that might not be true, because my mother always told me that when I was a little girl and she tried to read me a fairy tale, my first question when she opened the book was, is it really true? My sister, on the other hand, loved fairy tales, and she didn't care whether it was true or not. But it has always mattered to me, most of all, whether whatever I was writing was true. It's not always glamorous.
And that brings up another nuance to the whole discussion about truth, and that is that multiple, you know, when you look at a house, you can look at it from the front, you can look at it from the back, you can look at it from the inside, you can look at it from the Google satellite image, and it's all the same house, you know. And to me, it seemed like a lot of the problems that we face are just people looking at the same house, you know, from different perspectives, and then really not being able to reconcile that it's the same house just from different perspectives. You know, I look at an issue like, I had a conversation about offshore drilling, and, you know, offshore drilling poses a threat to the environment. It poses a threat to tourism. It is an asset for companies. It does build wealth. It does bring in tax revenue, which in turn helps run our cities. All of those things are true, and they're also in opposition to each other. So a lot of times it becomes a discussion about, you know, which of the perspectives is brought to the forefront or is the most important or is the most represented, you know?
Well, and what's the most important to the individual that's looking at it?
Yeah.
Do you need a big yard? Do you need a big garage? You know, all of the qualities that may or may not be in what you're looking at. And a lot of it will depend on what you need and want.
Right. And that goes back to, you know, trying to serve, you know, a disparate audience with one piece of content, because, you know, if you're not putting forth their particular perspective on offshore drilling, then they're going to say that's not right or that's slanted or that's, you know, because it's just not their biggest interest. Are you seeing any innovations or, you know, you still are active, you're still watching what people are doing. Has anything jumped up on your radar as far as cool innovations that you're seeing local news groups doing?
I have enjoyed working the Florida Phoenix, which I write columns for now, mostly columns, occasionally a news piece. But I find it fascinating because it's an online-only publication. They post the product on Facebook and Twitter, I guess, every day. And I don't look at Twitter as much as I look at Facebook. It's such a bucket of mud. But I'm interested in the fact that these things are informing people and you get a good bit of comment back on them. And yet you don't know who you're delivering it to, essentially. You know, we used to know that everybody in X neighborhood got the newspaper and probably knew what we were writing about. And the online nature of so much of the news nowadays doesn't give you that feeling that you know how widely something is being looked at as a reporter. But I think that the atmosphere of the news business over the last 4 years, I guess, maybe five, has grown much more hostile than it used to be for reporters to work in. And I wonder if that's not making a lot of people choose to do something else.
I think it definitely is. It's funny. It's just a lot of times we lament the people in certain professions, you know, without understanding that we create the environment that drives certain personality types into certain professions. And, you know, if you're an aggressive, you know, A-type personality, you tend to go one way. And if you're, you know, an activist, you may go another way. And, you know, for you as a truth seeker and valuing objectivity and objective truth, ideally, those are the type of people that become journalists. And, you know, if it starts to become a, you know, if the fake news thing takes too many roots or it's seen that news is activism, then you're going to get activists that come to it, which are a slightly different, you know, breed than just objective truth seekers. And it's something we have to sort of keep an eye on.
I look for this whole scene to get a lot more fragmented before it solidifies in some way. And I don't know what that does to it. It probably means that people are not as well informed across a broad spectrum of information. But particularly if people are biting off that little piece they like to read about or see and not making an effort to look at the whole picture that's before us every day.
You know, and I still think that comes down to the quality aggregation, because technically a newspaper is a bunch of individual content producers running around. And what paper is actually a platform for organizing and assigning and choosing the mix of what that content is going to look like. And, you know, you can do that. Right now we have social media platforms that let us self-select in doing that. But the problem is, you know, we're going to be driven by the shiny objects, the marketing, our own biases and all those sort of things, and shaping it ourselves, it's going to end up the way it kind of has. But perhaps the value comes in aggregation in a different form where it's not just, you know, one type pack of journalists, but multiple sources. And, you know, newspapers adopted this somewhat too with AP and, you know, pulling wire stories off as well. But I think that's what it ends up being. And I think you also have to respect the way, you know, the different modalities. So video, podcasts, those need to be brought in, which a lot of news organizations are.
I think the biggest problem facing newspapers right now is the ability to get a product out, get it quick, and make money off of it. And I mean, the easiest way to get it out is online. But it's not the easiest way to make a profit.
Right.
And somebody's got to figure that out and fix it for news organizations to subsist.
And I think the big reason why that is their competition in social media. If you think about the YouTube model, so essentially what they have is it's a meritocracy. So you have, you know, a million people putting content up every day, but only the best can monetize to any significant value. So, you know, the best is going to rise to the top. They're going to get rewarded and YouTube is going to share in that, but they're not going to have to pay the people who put the stuff that wasn't interesting up. and just had it, took all the time to do it. The newspaper has to pay everybody, right? They have to pay everybody whether their stories are making money or not. And so you're competing against almost sort of a perfect variable model that only pays for success and shares in success, which takes away the downside risk.
When I look at my own life over the span of years of raising children, of working every day, and now I don't have children around and I have more time, I cannot imagine spending the day looking at YouTube videos. I mean, who does that? Somebody must, because I guess they're making money, a lot of money probably. But I just find it hard to see the average American spending their days looking at YouTube videos.
Or input any social media, really. It's just what their particular, you know.
I tell you, though, we use Facebook in our family as a means of communicating things a lot of the times. Pictures of grandchildren. Here's Johnny's graduation, that kind of stuff. And cats. Well, I'm a cat person, so my cats are on Facebook more than they should be, but they don't know it. So I can see a purpose to that that unites friends and families a lot. I don't see that with things like YouTube, and not as much with places like Twitter, where you've got 140 characters to say something. And, you know, I grew up in the South. I can't say anything in 140 characters.
Yeah. And the idea is that you know, they provide that specific utility, and then that's the gravity that gets you there. And then the other stuff rides along with it, right? That's where the news rides along with. You're coming to see the cat pictures, but you're also seeing the news and, you know, kind of going next to it, right? And that's just been the path of least resistance for people to say, oh, well, I got a bunch of news here next to my cat pictures, so I'm not going to bother to go to the Tampa Bay Times site and look for news there. You know, obviously, the current climate notwithstanding, I don't want that to overshadow the fantastic career that you had. And so I'd love to get your, you know, other than the obvious, the Pulitzers, you know, what are the Pulitzer and the other being in the finalists? Can you tell me what you're most proudest of that you brought to journalism and, you know, how you existed in the community?
I am proudest of the moments that I was able to write a story which caused government, usually government, not always, but cause them to make things right for people.
Mm-hmm.
The best example I can think of is there was a small panhandle sheriff many years ago who was routinely requiring all female inmates in his jail to provide him with sex, bringing them into his office at the sheriff's department, and everybody knew it, but nobody did anything about it. And some of those women came to me with some help from a local judge and told me about it, and I wrote about it. The state attorney for that area didn't want to prosecute the sheriff because he thought it made law enforcement would look bad. But the U.S. attorney decided to do it. 22 women testified before a federal grand jury about their experience. They found lab evidence, FDLE did, in the sheriff's office to prove what had gone on in there, and he went to federal prison. None of those women had any money or any power, but they knew it was wrong, and they talked to me about it, and we published it and made it right. The guy was no longer in office when it was over. It's those kind of things that make me feel the best about news organizations. Sometimes the stories are horrible, but they need to be told. If some figure of authority who's being paid by our tax money is doing something like that. And so many people are afraid to tell those stories. Good newspapers exist to do that. You don't see a little weekly newspaper in a small town try to do those kind of stories for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of story that has always made me think, you know, that's why I'm here and what I'm doing.
When you did that story, which is, thank you for doing it. Obviously, that must have been a really stressful time. You're dealing with powerful people. You mentioned the sheriff on a separate issue, a separate incident, doing the bumper stickers. You know, how did you handle that? How did you handle the emotional toll of that? Did that trigger sort of an invigorated justice energy, or did you really have to recover from it?
Well, fortunately, I was married to a Times editor who had been a reporter, who had all of the educational credentials. He had a bachelor's and a master's from Northwestern in journalism. So, you know, he was sort of my guide in a lot of things, both at home and at work at times. And he retired many years before I did. But he was very strong through those moments. Our children were worried at times. When I was looking at the sheriff in Pasco County, my husband and I went to Mexico for 2 weeks, and we left our oldest daughter there to take care of his mother who lived with us. And she called us in Mexico one day, and she says, there's a deputy sheriff on the doorstep who says he's a friend of yours, and he wants to help us if we need any help. But I don't know whether he's friend or foe. Well, it turned out it was a guy who was friendly with us and had been helping. But in most of the situations, and there might be an exception, but it's the ones that come to mind, there were always good people who were helping me try to deal with the bad people. And I took a lot of strength from those people. I was careful. I did a series of stories in Dixie and Taylor County over drug smuggling and public corruption. There were a number of law enforcement people that were actually helping the smugglers. And I kept getting people who would call and say, oh, I've got a real good tip for you. Would you meet me on the Steinhatchee River Bridge at midnight? And I said, how about the courthouse steps at noon? You know, I'm not stupid. I'm not going to go expose myself. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement, when I was working on all those stories, urged me never to remain after dark in either Dixie or Taylor County. And that was in the 1980s, into the 90s, I think. I was prudent about where I went and who I went with, and sometimes took somebody with me. In Dixie County, when I entered the county, a green and white sheriff's recruiter would follow me everywhere I went. And the sheriff himself would call up people that if they had seen my car go to somebody's house, the sheriff would call them and threaten them, don't talk to her. I've had a lot of experiences where people tried to threaten me, but it was the right of what we were doing that made me continue on. And I don't know how I managed to make it, but I did and made it into retirement without anybody shooting me. But I think that most reporters who take on risky stories like that do it out of a sense that it's right and somebody needs to do it.
Right. And when you went through that, you know, as you dealt with the law enforcement folks and the warden, through all of it, did you keep a sense that it wasn't, you know, systematic sort of other that was you were working against? It was just individual bad actors, that the warden was sort of siloed off in what he was doing, even though he might have got a little protection from the AG.
I think I always felt that, yeah, they were bad actors and that somebody needed to write about them. Now, writing about them and exposing what they were doing did not always end with them going to jail the way the sheriff did.
Right.
But it often made things better for the people who were the subject of attacks from people like that. And the sheriff's office I was writing about was when I was in Tallahassee, and the sheriff's office was about 2 hours away from the Tallahassee Bureau, so that I'd never stayed overnight there. I would commute back into Tallahassee each time. And the night I came back from trial, when he was convicted and sentenced, the next morning when I went into the office, somebody had delivered a vase full of roses. The card with the roses said, from the women you believed. I have no idea where those flowers came from, but they're better than any Pulitzer I ever won, because it was a group of women who had no money, no clout, and someone did that from that group because I had freed them from a situation that was impossible. And that kind of benefit was the best feeling that you would ever get from doing those kind of stories.
Hugely important, and I think the perfect place to conclude our conversation. I very much appreciate it. Very much appreciate the energy and the drive for truth and justice and good journalism that you is still coming out of you today.
Well, thank you, Joe. I'm getting old now. I may soon get too old to remember what I'm doing, but as long as I'm having fun doing it, I'll probably do it for a while.
You've made it to the end of another great episode. For more SPX, visit stpx.com. Thanks again to our sponsors, CapEx Advisory Group, Build with Confidence. CapEx provides owner's representation for the most demanding construction projects. With deep knowledge of design, finance, construction, and public policy, CapEx brings your project to life. CapEx supports your organization with leadership and expertise to reduce cost and ease the burden on your team. Discover what an owner's rep can do for you. Discover CapEx Advisory Group. Visit CEAG2.com. That's CEAG, the number 2.com. And thanks also again to OPEN, the Open Partnership Education Network, which puts on great events around St. Petersburg, including Aresti speakers. To see the upcoming calendar of events, visit learnopen.org.